Part 3. Utopia. Chapter 10. A Framework for Utopia. No state more extensive than the minimal state can be justified. But doesn't the idea or ideal of the minimal state lack luster? Can it thrill the heart or inspire people to struggle or sacrifice? Would anyone man barricades under its banner? It seems pale and feeble in comparison with, to pick the polar extreme, the hopes and dreams of utopian theorists. Whatever its virtues, it appears clear that the minimal state is no utopia. We would expect, then, that an investigation into utopian theory should more than serve to highlight the defects and shortcomings of the minimal state as the end of political philosophy. Such an investigation also promises to be intrinsically interesting. Let us then pursue the theory of utopia to where it leads. The model. The totality of conditions we would wish to impose on societies which are preeminently to qualify as utopias, taken jointly, are inconsistent. That it is impossible simultaneously and continually to realize all social and political goods is a regrettable fact about the human condition, worth investigating and bemoaning. Our subject here, however, is the best of all possible worlds. For whom? The best of all possible worlds for me will not be that for you. The world, of all those I can imagine, which I would most prefer to live in, will not be precisely the one you would choose. Utopia, though, must be, in some restricted sense, the best for all of us, the best world imaginable for each of us. In what sense can this be? There is an ambiguity in the notion of the best possible world, corresponding to the different decision criteria discussed by decision theorists, are different principles of institutional design. The talk of designing institutions so that bad men at their head can do little harm, and of checks and balances, can be interpreted as prompted by a Minimax principle, or more accurately, by Minimax considerations built into a less stringent principle. See Kenneth Arrow and Leonid Hurwitz, An Optimality Criterion for Decision-Making Under Ignorance, in Uncertainty and Expectations in Economics, editor C. F. Carter and J. L. Ford, Clifton, New Jersey, Augustus M. Kelly, 1972, pages 1 to 11. Everyone who has considered the matter agrees that the Maximax principle, which chooses the action that has of its many possible consequences one which is better than any possible consequence of any other available action, is an insufficiently prudent principle which one would be silly to use in designing institutions. Any society whose institutions are infused by such wild optimism is headed for a fall, or, at any rate, the high risk of one makes the society too dangerous to choose to live in. But a society which does not have its institutions patterned by Maximax principles will not be able to reach the heights reachable, if things go well for it, by a Maximax society. Which society is the best possible? That, in accordance with the best principles of institutional design, which build in certain safeguards against bad eventualities at a cost of making some good ones more difficult of quick attainment, or that one of the possible ones in which things turn out best, the Maximax society in which the most favorable eventuality is realized. Perhaps no one's notion of utopia is precise enough to say which way this question is to be answered. Utopia to the side, the question that interests us here concerns the best principles of institutional design. Perhaps so as not to imply that it is possible or desirable to create major institutions de novo, we should speak of principles of institutional evaluation rather than of design. That my best world is not yours will seem to some to show the corruption and degeneracy of at least one of us, and not surprisingly, in their view, for we haven't been brought up in and shaped by utopia. So how could we be expected to be its perfect inhabitants? Hence the emphasis in utopian writings on the various processes of molding the young. Those people will find it utopia. But how much may they differ from us? Presumably a short nice history should lead from people like us to people like them. Utopia is where our grandchildren are to live, and the double generation gap is to be small enough so that we'll all happily realize we are part of the same family. People are not to be transformed. The ape description of their utopia does not begin, "First we evolve and then," nor, "First we start like tomatoes and crawling on the ground and then." Imagine a possible world in which to live. This world need not contain everyone else now alive, and it may contain beings who have never actually lived. Every rational creature in this world you have imagined will have the same rights of imagining a possible world for himself to live in which all other rational inhabitants have the same imagining rights and so on as you have. I use rational or rational creature as short for beings having those properties in virtue of which a being has those full rights that human beings have. I do not mean here to say anything about what those properties are. Some brief introductory remarks on the issue are contained in Chapter 3. The other inhabitants of the world you have imagined may choose to stay in the world which has been created for them, they have been created for, or they may choose to leave it and inhabit a world of their own imagining. If they choose to leave your world and live in another, your world is without them. You may choose to abandon your imagined world, now without its emigrants. This process goes on. Worlds are created, people leave them, create new worlds, and so on. Will the process go on indefinitely? Are all such worlds ephemeral, or are there some stable worlds in which all of the original population will choose to remain? If this process does result in some stable worlds, what interesting general conditions does each of them satisfy? If there are stable worlds, each of them satisfies one very desirable description by virtue of the way the worlds have been set up, namely, none of the inhabitants of the world can imagine an alternative world they would rather live in, which, they believe, would continue to exist if all of its rational inhabitants had the same rights of imagining and emigrating. This description is so very attractive that it is of great interest to see what other features are common to all such stable worlds. So that we continually do not have to repeat long descriptions, let us call a world which all rational inhabitants may leave for any other world they can imagine, in which all the rational inhabitants may leave for any other world they can imagine, in which an association. And let us call a world in which some rational inhabitants are not permitted to emigrate to some of the associations they can imagine, an East Berlin. Thus, our original attractive description says that no member of a stable association can imagine another association, which he believes would be stable, that he would rather be a member of. What are such stable associations like? Here I can offer only some intuitive and overly simple arguments. You will not be able to set up an association in which you are the absolute monarch, exploiting all the other rational inhabitants. For then they would be better off in an association without you, and at the very least, they all would choose to inhabit that one containing all of them, minus you, rather than remain in your creation. No stable association is such that everyone but one in it jointly would leave for their own association, for this would contradict the assumption that the original association was stable. This reasoning applies as well to two or three or n persons whom everyone else in an association would be better off without. Thus we have as a condition of stable associations, if A is a set of persons in a stable association, then there is no proper subset S of A such that each member of S is better off in an association consisting only of members of S than he is in A. For if there were such a subset S, its members would secede from A, establishing their own association. In a detailed exposition, we would have to consider whether there mightn't be such an S which would remain in A, because the members of S couldn't agree upon a particular division of goods among themselves, or whether there mightn't be many such overlapping subsets S whose complicated interactions, which one should a person enter, lead to everyone's staying in A. The condition we state is related to the notion of the core of a game. An allocation is blocked by a coalition S of persons if there is another allocation among the members of S which makes each of them better off, and which the members of S can bring about independently of other persons, independently of the relative complement of S. The core of a game consists of all those allocations which are not blocked by any coalition. In an economy, the core contains exactly those allocations to consumers, such that no subset of consumers can improve each member's position by reallocating their own assets among themselves, independently of the other consumers in the economy. It is a trivial consequence that every allocation in the core is Pareto optimal, and an interesting theorem that every equilibrium allocation of a competitive market is in the core. Furthermore, for every allocation in the core, there is a competitive market with an initial distribution of goods, which gives rise to it as an equilibrium allocation. For these results, with slight variance in the conditions necessary to prove the theorems, see Gerard de Brou and Herbert Scarf, A Limit Theorem on the Core of an Economy, International Economic Review, 4, No. 3, 1963, Robert Aumann, Markets with a Continuum of Traders, Econometrica, 32, 1964, and for a statement of sufficient conditions for a core to be non-empty, Herbert Scarf, The Core of an N-Person Game, Econometria, 35, 1967. These articles have given rise to an extensive literature. See Kenneth Arrow and Frank Hahn, General Competitive Analysis, San Francisco, Holden Day, 1971. Since the notion of core they study is obviously central to our possible world situation, one would expect results close to theirs to carry over to our case as well. A compendium of other useful and suggestive material having relevance to the possible world's model is Gerard de Brou, Theory of Value, New York, Wiley, 1959. Unfortunately, our possible world's model is more complicated in some ways than the ones these references study, so that their results cannot be carried over directly and immediately. Suppose that you are spokesman for all of the rational beings other than me in the world I have imagined and created. Your decision between staying in my association A sub 1 or starting another one, A sub 1 prime, containing all of you but not containing me, is the same decision as the one of whether to admit me as a new member into an association A sub 1 prime, which you all already belong to, giving me the same role in the expanded A sub 1 prime as I have in A sub 1. In each case, the crucial fact which determines the decision is the same, namely, are you better off with me or without me? Thus, in order to determine which of the many worlds, A sub 1, A sub 2, dot, 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 that I can imagine would have all of its rational members stay in association with me rather than form associations A sub 1 prime, A sub 2 prime, dot, 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 containing all of them but not me, we may consider all of the associations, A sub 1 prime, A sub 2 prime, dot, 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 as already existing, and ask which of them would admit me as a new member, and on what terms. No association will admit me if I take more from the association than I give to it. They will not choose to lose by admitting me. What I take from the association is not the same as what I get from it. What I take is how much they value what they give me under the arrangement. What I get is how much I value my membership. Supposing for the moment that the group is united and can be represented by one utility function, where U sub Y of X is the utility of X for Y, an association A sub I prime will admit me only if U sub A sub I prime of admitting me is greater than or equal to U sub A sub I prime of excluding me, that is, U sub A sub I prime of being in A sub I is greater than or equal to U sub A sub I prime of being in A sub I prime, that is, what those in A sub I prime gain from my membership is greater than or equal to what they give up to me to get me into the association. From no association will I be able to get something worth more to them than what I contribute is worth to them. Need I accept less than this from any association? If one association offers me less than they would gain from my presence, it will be to the advantage of another association that values my presence equally to offer me something more than the first, though less than they would gain, in order to get me to join their association rather than the first. Similarly, for a third association with regard to the second, and so on. There can be no collusion among associations to keep my payment down, since I can imagine any number of other entrants into the market for my presence, and so associations will bid up their offers to me. We seem to have a realization of the economist's model of a competitive market. This is most welcome, for it gives us immediate access to a powerful, elaborate, and sophisticated body of theory and analysis. Many associations competing for my membership are the same structurally as many firms competing to employ me. In each case, I receive my marginal contribution. Thus, it seems, we have the result that, in every stable association, each person receives his marginal contribution. In each world whose rational members can imagine worlds and emigrate to them, and in which no rational member can imagine another world he would rather live in which each person has the same imagining and emigrating rights, which he thinks would endure, each person receives his marginal contribution to the world. Our argument thus far has been intuitive. We shall offer no formal argument here. But we should say something more about the content of the model. The model is designed to let you choose what you will, with the sole constraint being that others may do the same for themselves and refuse to stay in the world you have imagined. But this alone does not create in the model the requisite sort of equality in the exercise of rights, for you have imagined and created some of those persons, whereas they have not imagined you. You may have imagined them with certain wants, and in particular you may have imagined them as most wanting to live in a world with the precise character you have created, even though in it they are abject slaves. In this case, they will not leave your world for a better one. For in their view, there cannot be a better one. No other worlds could successfully compete for their membership, and so their payoff will not be bid up in a competitive market. What natural and intuitive restrictions should be placed on what the beings are imagined to be like in order to avoid this result? To avoid the messiness of a frontal assault that describes the constraints on what the people imagined are like, we impose the following constraint. The world cannot be imagined so that it logically follows that one, its inhabitants, or one of them, most, or nth most, want to live in it, or two, its inhabitants, or one of them, most, or nth most, want to live in a world with a certain kind of person and will do whatever he says, and so on. For each way in which trouble can be caused, once we or someone else thinks of it, we can explicitly exclude it by a proviso of the constraint. And this procedure will do, for our purposes, so long as there is a finite number of ways that the construction can be overturned. Imposing this constraint does not trivialize our construction, for the argument to the result about payment according to marginal contribution is the interesting theoretical step provided by economic theory and game theory. Focused wants directed to particular people or a particular possible world would constitute a roadblock in getting from our initial starting place to the result. There is independent intuitive reason to eliminate those focused wants, apart from the fact that it prevents the derivation of the result, and the details of the limitations on the initial situation to avoid these wants are not themselves likely to be of independent interest. It is best, then, merely to exclude these wants. The epistemology of the situation needn't disturb us. No one can circumvent the constraint by depending on the fact that follows from is not an effective notion. For as soon as it is known that one or two, or an added proviso, does follow, the imagined world is excluded. More serious is the problem that something may follow causally, even though it does not logically follow. This would make it unnecessary to say explicitly that one of these imagined persons most wants X. Given a causal theory about the generation of wants, for example, some theory of operant conditioning, The person might imagine that someone has undergone just that past history which his empirical theory tells him causally produces the want for X as stronger than his other wants. Again, various ad hoc restrictions suggest themselves, but it seems best simply to add the additional constraint that the imaginer may not describe people in the world so that he knows it follows causally, that continuing as in the logically follows condition. It is only what he knows follows that we wish to exclude. It would be too strong to require that no such thing actually follow from his imagined description. If he doesn't know about it, he can't exploit it. Though the imaginer of the world cannot design other persons so as to specially favor his own position, he might imagine others accepting certain general principles. These general principles might favor his situation. For example, he might imagine that everyone in the world, including himself, accepts a principle of equal division of product, admitting anyone to the world with an equal share. If the population of a world unanimously accepts some other general principle P of distribution, then each person in that world will receive their P share instead of their marginal contribution. Unanimity is required, for any dissident accepting a different general distributive principle P prime will move to a world containing only adherents of P prime. In a marginal contribution world, of course, any individual may choose to give some of his share to another as a gift, unless, though it is difficult to see what would be the motivation for this, their general principle of distribution requires distribution according to marginal contribution and contains a proviso against gifts. Therefore, in each world, everyone receives his marginal product, some of which he may transfer to others, who thereby receive more than their marginal product, or everyone unanimously consents to some other principle of distribution. This seems an appropriate point to note that not all of the worlds will be desirable ones. The special principle P that all the inhabitants of some world are imagined to favor might be quite atrocious. Our imaginary construction has been devised to focus only upon certain aspects of the relations among persons. Do the particular details of the construction allow not only an infinite number of communities demanding someone's presence, but also their imagining an infinite number of candidates for inclusion? This would be unfortunate, for in a market with infinite supply and infinite demand, the price is theoretically indeterminate. But our construction involves each person imagining a finite number of others to inhabit his world with him. If these leave, he may imagine yet finitely many others. The first people who left are now out of the picture. They do not compete with the new arrivals, being busy with their own tasks of world constructing. Though there is no finite upper limit to the number a person may imagine in the process, in no world is there an actual infinity of people competing for shares. And imagining a world in which, because of external circumstances, a person's marginal product is low makes it unlikely that he will choose to stay put. Are there any stable worlds at all? In place of an association in which someone receives his quite low contribution, he will imagine an alternative association in which his contribution is higher than that in the first, and will leave the first, rendering it unstable. By this reasoning, won't he imagine and choose to inhabit that association in which his contribution, and hence payment, is greatest? Won't everyone populate his association with maximally appreciative association mates? Is there some group of beings larger than unit sets who will be mutually maximally appreciative? That is, some group G that for each member, X of G, G minus bracket X values X's presence more than any other possible group of people would value X's presence? Even if there is some such group G, is there one or another for everybody? For each person, is there some mutually maximally appreciative group of which he is a member? Fortunately, the competition isn't so keen. We needn't consider groups G such that for each member X of G, G minus bracket X values X's presence more than any other possible group would value X's presence. We need only consider groups G such that for each member X of G, G minus bracket X values X's presence more than any other possible stable group of people would value X's presence. A stable group G is a mutually maximally appreciative group where for each member X, G minus bracket X values X's presence more than any other possible stable group. Clearly, this circular explanation of stability won't do, and to say a group that will last from which no one will emigrate isn't closely enough tied to theory-laden notions to give interesting results, for example, that there are stable groups. Similar problems about stable coalitions have been faced by game theorists with only partial success, and our problem is more difficult theoretically. Indeed, we have not yet imposed conditions sufficient to guarantee the existence of a stable finite group, for it is compatible with all we've said that, on some scale of measurement above some n, the utility income of a community with n members equals n squared. If the community divides utility equally, they will expand indefinitely, with people leaving each community for a larger one. Prospects for stable associations are improved when we realize that the supposition that each person receives only what others give up to him is too strong. A world may give a person something worth more to him than the worth to the others of what they give up to him. A major benefit to a person may come, for example, from coexisting in the world with the others and being a part of the normal social network. Giving him the benefit may involve essentially no sacrifice by the others. Thus, in one world, a person may get something worth more to him than his payoff from the stable association which most values his presence. Though they give up less, he gets more. Since a person wishes to maximize what he gets, rather than what he is given, no person will imagine a maximally appreciative world of inferior beings to whose existence he is crucial. No one will choose to be a queen bee. Nor will a stable association consist of narcissistic persons competing for primacy along the same dimensions. Rather, it will contain a diversity of persons with a diversity of excellences and talents, each benefiting from living with the others, each being of great use or delight to the others, complementing them. And each person prefers being surrounded by a galaxy of persons of diverse excellence and talent equal to his own, to the alternative of being the only shining light in a pool of relative mediocrity. All admire each other's individuality, basking in the full development in others of aspects and potentialities of themselves left relatively undeveloped. The model we sketch here seems well worth investigating in detail. It is intrinsically interesting, promises deep results, is a natural way to approach the subject of the best of all possible worlds, and constitutes an area for the application of the most developed theories dealing with the choice of rational agents, namely decision theory, game theory, and economic analysis, tools which surely must be of importance for political philosophy and ethics. It applies these theories not merely by using their results in the area for which they were intended, but by discussing a situation, other than the one theorists considered, which is, in the logician's technical sense, a model of the theories. The model projected onto our world. In our actual world, what corresponds to the model of possible worlds is a wide and diverse range of communities which people can enter if they are admitted, leave if they wish to, shape according to their wishes. A society in which utopian experimentation can be tried, different styles of life can be lived, and alternative visions of the good can be individually or jointly pursued. The details and some of the virtues of such an arrangement, which we shall call the framework, will emerge as we proceed. There are important differences between the model and the model's projection onto the actual world. The problems with the operation of the framework in the actual world stem from the divergencies between our earthbound actual life and the possible worlds model we have been discussing, raising the question of whether, even if the realization of the model itself would be ideal, the realization of its pale projection is the best we can do here. 1. Unlike the model, we cannot create all the people whose existence we desire, so that even if there were a possible maximally mutually valuing association containing you, its other members actually may not exist, and the other persons among whom you actually live will not constitute your best fan club. Also, there may be a particular kind of community you wish to live in, yet not enough other actual people can be persuaded to wish to live in such a community so as to give it a viable population. In the model for a diverse range of non-exploitative communities, there are always enough other persons who wish to live in one. 2. Unlike the model, in the actual world, communities impinge upon one another, creating problems of foreign relations and self-defense, and necessitating modes of adjudicating and resolving disputes between the communities. In the model, one association impinges upon another only by drawing away some of its members. 3. In the actual world, there are information costs in finding out what other communities there are and what they are like, and moving and travel costs in going from one community to another. 4. Furthermore, in the actual world, some communities may try to keep some of their members ignorant of the nature of other alternative communities they might join, to try to prevent them from freely leaving their own community to join another. This raises the problem of how freedom of movement is to be institutionalized and enforced when there are some who will wish to restrict it. Given the formidable differences between the actual world and the model of possible worlds, of what relevance is that fantasy to it? One should not be too quick here or elsewhere with such fantasies, for they reveal much about our condition. One cannot know how satisfied we shall be with what we achieve among our feasible alternatives without knowing how far they diverge from our fantasized wishes. And it is only by bringing such wishes and their force into the picture that we shall understand people's efforts toward expanding the range of their currently feasible alternatives. The details into which some utopian writers plunge indicate a blurring of their line between fantasy and the feasible, not to mention the actually predicted. For example, Fourier's view that the seas would turn to lemonade, friendly anti-lions and anti-tigers would evolve, and so on. Even the wildest hopes and predictions, such as Trotsky's in Closing Literature and Revolution, express pangs and a longing whose omission from a portrait of us leaves it merely three-dimensional. I do not laugh at the content of our wishes that go not only beyond the actual and what we take to be feasible in the future, but even beyond the possible, nor do I wish to denigrate fantasy or minimize the pangs of being limited to the possible. The realization of the possible world situation would involve the satisfaction of various conditions. We cannot actually satisfy all of these conditions, but we can satisfy many of them. Even if satisfying all of them would be the best situation, it is not obvious, given that we cannot satisfy all, that we should try to satisfy each of the ones it is possible to satisfy, even if it is jointly possible to satisfy these latter. Perhaps near misses of the totality of conditions are worse than great divergencies. Perhaps we should intentionally violate some of the conditions which it is possible to satisfy in order to compensate for, or adjust for, the necessary violation of some of the other considerations. Our consideration of alternative arguments for the framework, and discussion of objections to it, will make a case for, but not establish, the proposition that it would be better to realize the framework than to realize alternatives even more divergent from the possible world's model than it. We should note here that some of the ways the framework diverges from the possible world's model, though making the framework less desirable than the possible world's model, leave it more desirable than any other actually realizable situation. For example, in the actual operation of the framework, there will be only a limited number of communities, so that for many people, no one community will exactly match their values and the weighting they give them. Under the framework, each individual chooses to live in the actual community which, putting it roughly, comes closest to realizing what is most important to him. But the problem about no community exactly fitting someone's values arises only because people disagree about their values and their weighting. If there were no disagreement, there would be enough other people to populate the exactly desired community. so there will be no way to satisfy all of the values of more than one person if only one set of values can be satisfied. Other persons will have their values more or less closely satisfied. But if there is a diverse range of communities, then, putting it roughly, more persons will be able to come closer to how they wish to live than if there is only one kind of community. The framework. It would be disconcerting if there were only one argument or connected set of reasons for the adequacy of a particular description of utopia. Utopia is the focus of so many different strands of aspiration that there must be many theoretical paths leading to it. Let us sketch some of these alternate, mutually supporting theoretical routes. In order to keep the line of argument here independent of the first two parts of this audiobook, I do not discuss here the moral arguments for individual liberty. The first route begins with the fact that people are different. They differ in temperament, interests, intellectual ability, aspirations, natural bent, spiritual quests, and the kind of life they wish to lead. They diverge in the values they have, and have different weightings for the values they share. They wish to live in different climates, some in mountains, plains, deserts, seashores, cities, towns. There is no reason to think that there is one community which will serve as ideal for all people, and much reason to think that there is not. We may distinguish among the following theses. Roman 1. For each person there is a kind of life that objectively is the best for him. A. People are similar enough so that there is one kind of life which objectively is the best for each of them. B. People are different, so that there is not one kind of life which objectively is the best for everyone. And 1. The different kinds of life are similar enough so that there is one kind of community, meeting certain constraints, which objectively is the best for everyone. 2. The different kinds of life are so different that there is not one kind of community, meeting certain constraints, which objectively is the best for everyone, no matter which of these different lives is best for them. Roman 2. For each person, so far as objective criteria of goodness can tell, insofar as these exist, there is a wide range of very different kinds of life that tie as best. No other is objectively better for him than any one in this range, and no one within the range is objectively better than any other. And there is not one community which objectively is the best for the living of each selection set from the family of sets of not objectively inferior lives. For our purposes at this point, either of Roman 1b2 or Roman 2 will serve. Wittgenstein, Elizabeth Taylor, Bertrand Russell, Thomas Merton, Yogi Berra, Allen Ginsberg, Harry Wolfson, Thoreau, Casey Stengel, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Picasso, Moses, Einstein, Hugh Hefner, Socrates, Henry Ford, Lenny Bruce, Baba Ram Dass, Gandhi, Sir Edmund Hillary, Raymond Lubitz, Buddha, Frank Sinatra, Columbus, Freud, Norman Mailer, Ayn Rand, Baron Rothschild, Ted Williams, Thomas Edison, H.L. Mencken, Thomas Jefferson, Ralph Ellison, Bobby Fischer, Emma Goldman, Peter Kropotkin, you, and your parents. Is there really one kind of life which is best for each of these people? Imagine all of them living in any utopia you've ever seen described in detail. Try to describe the society which would be best for all of these persons to live in. Would it be agricultural or urban, of great material luxury or of austerity with basic needs satisfied? What would relations between the sexes be like? Would there be any institution similar to marriage? Would it be monogamous? Would children be raised by their parents? Would there be private property? Would there be a serene, secure life, or one with adventures, challenges, dangers, and opportunities for heroism? Would there be one, many, any religion? How important would it be in people's lives? Would people view their life as importantly centered about private concerns or about public action and issues of public policy? Would they be single-mindedly devoted to particular kinds of accomplishments and work, or jacks of all trades and pleasures, or would they concentrate on full and satisfying leisure activities? Would children be raised permissively, strictly? What would their education concentrate upon? Will sports be important in people's lives, as spectators, participants? Will art? Will sensual pleasures or intellectual activities predominate? Or what? Will there be fashions in clothing? Will great pains be taken to beautify appearance? What will the attitude toward death be? Would technology and gadgets play an important role in the society? And so on. The idea that there is one best composite answer to all of these questions, one best society for everyone to live in, seems to me to be an incredible one. And the idea that if there is one, we now know enough to describe it, is even more incredible. No one should attempt to describe a utopia unless he's recently reread, for example, the works of Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Jane Austen, Rabelais, and Dostoevsky, to remind himself how different people are. It will also serve to remind him of how complex they are, as we'll discuss in the third route below. Utopian authors, each very confident of the virtues of his own vision and of its singular correctness, have differed among themselves, no less than the people mentioned above differ, in the institutions and kinds of life they present for emulation. Though the picture of an ideal society that each presents is much too simple, even for the component communities we'll discuss, we should take the fact of the differences seriously. No utopian author has everyone in his society leading exactly the same life, allocating exactly the same amount of time to exactly the same activities. Why not? Don't the reasons also count against just one kind of community? The conclusion to draw is that there will not be one kind of community existing and one kind of life led in Utopia. Utopia will consist of utopias, of many different and divergent communities in which people lead different kinds of lives under different institutions. Some kinds of communities will be more attractive to most than others. Communities will wax and wane. People will leave some for others or spend their whole lives in one. Utopia is a framework for utopias, a place where people are at liberty to join together voluntarily to pursue and attempt to realize their own vision of the good life in the ideal community, but where no one can impose his own utopian vision upon others. The utopian society is the society of utopianism. Some, of course, may be content where they are. Not everyone will be joining special experimental communities, and many who abstain at first will join the communities later, after it is clear how they actually are working out. Half of the truth I wish to put forth is that utopia is meta-utopia. The environment in which utopian experiments may be tried out, the environment in which people are free to do their own thing, the environment which must, to a great extent, be realized first if more particular utopian visions are to be realized stably. If, as we noted at the beginning of this chapter, not all goods can be realized simultaneously, then trade-offs will have to be made. The second theoretical route notes that there is little reason to believe that one unique system of trade-offs will command universal assent. Different communities, each with a slightly different mix, will provide a range from which each individual can choose that community which best approximates his balance among competing values. Its opponents will call this the smorgasbord conception of utopia, preferring restaurants with only one dinner available, or rather preferring a one-restaurant town with one item on the menu. Design devices and filter devices. The third theoretical route to the framework for utopia is based on the fact that people are complex, as are the webs of possible relationships among them. Suppose falsely that the earlier arguments are mistaken and that one kind of society is best for all. How are we to find out what this society is like? Two methods suggest themselves, which we shall call design devices and filter devices. Design devices construct something or its description by some procedure which does not essentially involve constructing descriptions of others of its type. The result of the process is one object. In the case of societies, the result of the design process is a description of one society, obtained by people or a person sitting down and thinking about what the best society is. After deciding, they set about to pattern everything on this model. Given the enormous complexity of man, his many desires, aspirations, impulses, talents, mistakes, loves, silliness, given the thickness of his intertwined and interrelated levels, facets, relationships, compare the thinness of the social scientist's description of man to that of the novelist, and given the complexity of interpersonal institutions and relationships, and the complexity of coordination of the actions of many people, it is enormously unlikely that, even if there were one ideal pattern for society, it could be arrived at in this a priori, relative to current knowledge, fashion. And even supposing that some great genius did come along with the blueprint, who would have confidence that it would work out well? No person or group I or you know of could come up with an adequate blueprint, much less be trusted to do so, for a society of beings as complex personally and interpersonally as they themselves are. In fact, no utopia has ever been described in which any sane man would on any conditions consent to live, if he could possibly escape. Alexander Gray, The Socialist Tradition, New York, Harper and Row, 1968, page 63. In view of this, it is strategically shrewd of groups who wish to totally remake all of society according to one pattern to eschew stating that pattern in detail and to keep us in the dark about how things will work after their change. No blueprints. The behavior of the followers is less easy to understand, but perhaps the more vague the picture, the more each person can assume that it is really exactly what he wants that is planned and will be brought about. Sitting down at this late stage in history to dream up a description of the perfect society is not, of course, the same as starting from scratch. We have available to us partial knowledge of the results of application of devices other than design devices, including partial application of the filter device to be described. It is helpful to imagine cavemen sitting together to think up what, for all time, will be the best possible society, and then setting out to institute it. Do none of the reasons that make you smile at this apply to us? Filter devices involve a process which eliminates, filters out, many from a large set of alternatives. The two key determinants of the end results are the particular nature of the filtering out process and what qualities it selects against, and the particular nature of the set of alternatives it operates upon, and how this set is generated. Filtering processes are especially appropriate for designers having limited knowledge who do not know precisely the nature of a desired end product, for it enables them to utilize their knowledge of specific conditions they don't want violated in judiciously building a filter to reject the violators. It might turn out to be impossible to design an appropriate filter, and one might try another filter process for this task of design. But generally, it seems, less knowledge, including knowledge of what is desirable, will be required to produce an appropriate filter, even one that converges uniquely upon a particular kind of product, than would be necessary to construct only the product from scratch. Furthermore, if the filtering process is of the type that involves a variable method of generating new candidates, so that their quality improves as the quality of the members remaining after previous filtering operations improves, and it also involves a variable filter that becomes more selective as the quality of the candidates sent into it improves, that is, it rejects some candidates which previously had passed successfully through the filter, then one legitimately may expect that the merits of what will remain after long and continued operation of the process will be very high indeed. We should not be too haughty about the results of filter processes, being one ourselves. From the vantage point of the considerations leading us to recommend a filter process in the constructing of societies, evolution is a process for creating living beings appropriately chosen by a modest deity who does not know precisely what the being he wishes to create is like. Compare, nor is this world inhabited by man the first of things earthly created by God. He made several worlds before ours, but he destroyed them all because he was pleased with none until he created ours. Lewis Ginsburg, Legends of the Bible, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1961, page 2. The whole subject of filtering devices, deterministic and stochastic, and how they should differ for different kinds of tasks, is tremendously interesting. There is not, to my knowledge, any detailed theory of optimal filters relative to their tasks and their features. One would expect that the work on mathematical models of evolution and evolutionary theory itself would be useful and suggestive in beginning to construct such a general theory. See R.C. Lewontin, Evolution and Theory of Games, Journal of Theoretical Biology, 1960, Howard Levine, Genetic Diversity and Diversity of Environments, Mathematical Aspects in the 5th Berkeley Symposium, Volume 4, and the references cited therein, Crow and Kimura, Introduction to Population Genetics Theory, New York, Harper and Row, 1970. Consider as another illustration the issues of genetic engineering. Many biologists tend to think the problem is one of design, of specifying the best types of persons so that biologists can proceed to produce them. Thus, they worry over what sort of person there is to be and who will control this process. They do not tend to think, perhaps because it diminishes the importance of their role, of a system in which they run a genetic supermarket, meeting the individual specifications, within certain moral limits, of prospective parents. Nor do they think of seeing what limited number of types of persons people's choices would converge upon, if indeed there would be any such convergence. This supermarket system has the great virtue that it involves no centralized decision fixing the future human types. If it is worried that some important ratios will be altered, for example, of males and females, a government could require that genetic manipulation be carried on so as to fit a certain ratio. Supposing for simplicity that the desired ratio is 1-to-1, hospitals and clinics could be required, at least as a bookkeeping arrangement, to pair couples desiring a male child with those desiring a female before aiding either couple in realizing their desires. If more couples desired one alternative, couples would pay others to form the opposite couple in the pair, and a market would develop to the economic benefit of those indifferent about the sex of their next child. Maintenance of such a macro ratio would appear to be more difficult in a purely libertarian system. Under it, either parents would subscribe to an information service monitoring the recent births and so know which sex was in shorter supply, and hence would be more in demand later in life, thus adjusting their activities, or interested individuals would contribute to a charity that offers bonuses to maintain the ratio, or the ratio would leave 1-to-1, with new family and social patterns developing. A filtering process for specifying a society which might come to mind is one in which the people planning out the ideal society consider many different kinds of societies and criticize some, eliminate some, modify the descriptions of others, until they come to the one they consider best. This, no doubt, is how any design team would work, and so it should not be assumed that design devices exclude filtering features. Nor need filtering devices exclude design aspects, especially in the generating process. But one cannot determine in advance which people will come up with the best ideas, and all ideas must be tried out, and not merely simulated on a computer, to see how they will work. And some ideas will come only as we are post facto trying to describe what patterns have evolved from the spontaneous coordination of the actions of many people. For some writers, the most interesting points come after they think they've thought everything through and have begun to set it down. Sometimes, at this stage, there is a change in point of view or a realization that it is something different one must write, on what, before writing, one assumed was a subsidiary and clear subject. How much greater will be the differences between a plan, even one written down, and the working out in detail of the life of a society? If the ideas must actually be tried out, there must be many communities trying out different patterns. The filtering process, the process of eliminating communities that our framework involves, is very simple. People try out living in various communities, and they leave or slightly modify the ones they don't like, find defective. Some communities will be abandoned, others will struggle along, Others will split, others will flourish, gain members, and be duplicated elsewhere. Each community must win and hold the voluntary adherence of its members. No pattern is imposed on everyone, and the result will be one pattern if and only if everyone voluntarily chooses to live in accordance with that pattern of the community. The design device comes in at the stage of generating specific communities to be lived in and tried out. Any group of people may devise a pattern and attempt to persuade others to participate in the adventure of a community in that pattern. Visionaries and crackpots, maniacs and saints, monks and libertines, capitalists and communists and participatory democrats, proponents of phalanxes, Fourier, palaces of labor, Flora Tristan, villages of unity and cooperation, Owen, mutualist communities, Proudhon, Time Stores, Josiah Warren, Bruderhof, Kibbutzim, Kundalini Yoga Ashrams, and so forth, may all have their try at building their vision and setting an alluring example. It should not be thought that every pattern tried will be explicitly designed de novo. Some will be planned modifications, however slight, of others already existing, when it is seen where they rub. And the details of many will be built up spontaneously in communities that leave some leeway. As communities become more attractive for their inhabitants, patterns previously adopted as the best available will be rejected. And as the communities which people live in improve, according to their lights, ideas for new communities often will improve as well. The operation of the framework for utopia we present here thus realizes the advantages of a filtering process incorporating mutually improving interaction between the filter and the surviving products of the generating process, so that the quality of generated and non-rejected products improves. Furthermore, given people's historical memories and records, it has the feature that an already rejected alternative, or its slight modification, can be retried, perhaps because new or changed conditions make it now seem more promising or appropriate. This is unlike biological evolution, where previously rejected mutations cannot easily be recalled when conditions change. Also, evolutionists point out the advantages of genetic heterogeneity, polytypic and polymorphic, when conditions change greatly. Similar advantages adhere to a system of diverse communities, organized along different lines, and perhaps encouraging different types of character and different patterns of abilities and skills. This framework is not the only possible filter process for the task of arriving at a desirable or the best society, though I cannot think of another which would have the special interaction virtues to so great an extent. So the general virtues of filter processes over design devices do not argue uniquely for it.